Welcome to the latest episode of Primary Care Update. I'm Dr. Mark A. Bell. I'm a family physician, professor at University of Georgia, and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus. Essential Evidence is an online, evidence-based primary care reference, over 800 chapters, all of the poems dating back to 1994, Cochrane abstracts, thousands of interactive calculators, and a lot more. Plus, subscribers can get every poem. We write about 25 a month in their inbox. Check it out at EssentialEvidencePlus.com. Primary Care Update is our summary of recent research that we think is relevant to primary care medicine, usually chosen from those poems. The opinions expressed are those of the commentators, and this podcast doesn't represent medical advice or the endorsement of any product. Joined today by Dr. John Hickner, family physician and editor of the Journal of Family Practice, and Dr. Henry Berry, professor of family medicine at Michigan State. Hello, guys.
Hello.
Hello, Mark.
How's everyone?
Doing quite well. I was just going to share with our listeners that Mark and I and our colleagues just saw some fascinating news. We had a paper published last fall related to the top poems over the last 20 years, and Altometrics, which is a mechanism for rating how often papers are cited in social media and the like. And our paper happened to reach the top 5% of all research ever reviewed by Altometrics.
Fantastic.
Not bad. Not bad. See, folks, listeners, those poems are worth paying attention to. And we're going to cover three of them today in our podcast. And the first one is John's about statins.
Yes, this study answers the question, or attempts to answer the question, are statins effective in patients older than 75? This study was published in Lancet just this year, 2019, volume 393, starting on page 407. And this is a collaboration by the Cholesterol Treatment Trialists Collaboration, a group of investigators who focus on cholesterol treatment. They did a terrific patient-level data meta-analysis that included data from 28 studies. They included patients 75 and older, 14,000 in total, which was about 8% of the total study entry data in these studies. These patients were followed up for a median of 5 years, and they looked at several outcomes in this meta-analysis. They looked at the non-fatal myocardial infarction or coronary death rate, coronary revascularization, but they also looked at stroke, cancers, and all-cause mortality. Now, taken in whole, that is all patients older than 75, there was a slight effect of statin treatment, with a 2.6% of patients experiencing a major coronary event each year compared to 3%, so 0.4% difference in those on statin versus not, for a number needed to treat of 250, which is awfully large. Now, keep in mind that included all comers, and when they attempted to do an analysis of the subgroup who did not have vascular disease at time of entry, they really had a fairly small number, but they did analyze that data and found that there was really no difference in patients who did not have vascular disease. So it is of no benefit if you did not have established vascular disease by age 75. Thankfully, there was no effect on cancer incidence or mortality or overall mortality. And interestingly, the rate of stroke was not significantly decreased with statins, which surprised me a bit. So I think the bottom line is that in patients 75 and older, if they've never been on a statin before, and if they even if they have a high cholesterol and have not had vascular events, that it probably is not worthwhile to start them on one. I wanted to comment that the new American Heart Association, American College of Cardiology cholesterol guidelines, of course, just came out this past year. And in their guidelines, they say, quote, it may be reasonable to treat individuals 75 and over. I'm not so sure that's good advice. I think it may not be reasonable, and that's probably correct. And if you're interested in this topic, one of our colleagues, Neil Skolnick, wrote a very nice commentary in the April 2nd JAMA issue in which he addresses this issue of treatment of elderly with statins.
Yeah, that was a really nice editorial, John, the Neil Skolnick's editorial, I thought. And he really, you know, that was what he centered on, was that comment that it may be, and every time you hear it may be reasonable, you should think to yourself, may not be reasonable. I think I learned that one from our friend Ken Milne, who has a series of podcasts and who we used to do work with. But yeah, this is not terribly surprising. If you have primary prevention, there's almost always less impressive benefit than secondary prevention. And there've been some other data that, you know, support this from other studies, that the benefit seems to diminish over 75, certainly over age 80. Henry, what do you think?
Yeah, so I think the main points here is that if you have an elder who has already had a heart attack or a stroke, this is not the group that we're talking about. We're talking about those that have never had a vascular event. The ALLHAT trial, which is a relatively older study, not only did it show no additional benefit for primary prevention, there was a trend to harm in treating those patients over 75 years of age. And so we do have to be careful. Now, John, you mentioned the new guideline. I did a little bit of statistical jujitsu and took a hypothetical 50-year-old with a systolic blood pressure of 120 millimeters of mercury, a total cholesterol of 200, and an HDL of 40, and plugged them into the pooled cohort equation. For the 50-year-old male, their 10-year risk of having an event would be 4%. If you took a 60-year-old with those same parameters, they would go up to 9%. And if you took a 75-year-old, their 10-year risk goes all the way up to 24%. So even though these individuals may be at much higher risk, even with what appear to be modest or normal kinds of lipid levels, this study would suggest that we might not benefit them by starting a statin.
So what about those patients who are already taking a statin, who've been doing fine on it, happily taking their, you know, 10 Lipitor, 20 Lipitor, whatever? What do we do with them? Any thoughts on whether we should be taking patients off, or if they're tolerating it okay, do we just say, you know, let's leave well enough alone?
The right answer is always shared decision-making.
Yeah, so I guess what you're saying is it depends on what kind of a burden that might be, if the patient's experiencing side effects, that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, interesting poem. Thank you for bringing that to us, John. Henry, time to turn to you for this week's quiz.
Yeah, so we're still in April, and in the April issue of the Journal of the American Geriatric Society, they updated their Beers criteria, which is the inspiration for this month's quiz. So the question is, the Beers criteria, one, state that one should consume beer before wine to avoid hangovers. Two, include a very short list of drugs that are approved for use in the elderly. Three, are a set of rules that insurers and government agencies should use to deny payment for medications. Four, include a list of medications that are definitely inappropriate for use in all elderly patients. Five, include a list of medications that are potentially inappropriate for use in elderly patients. Stay tuned.
All right. And speaking of beer, my next poem is Grape or Grain, But Never the Twain, a randomized controlled multi-arm matched triplet crossover trial of beer and wine. It's in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, 2019. And they asked the question, does consuming wine before beer really cause more hangovers than consuming beer before wine? And my father used to say many things, always in German, because he was from Germany, which makes sense. And he would say, Wein nach Bier, das rate ich dir. Bier nach Wein, lass es sein, which kind of said the same thing. So beer after wine, not a good idea. And I always took that, I've never quite understood the logic of that. And I must say, I've pretty much ignored it my entire life. But we're going to find out what the research shows. So lots of cultures have this kind of folk wisdom that wine before beer is worse than beer before wine. So these researchers recruited 105 lucky adults, 18 to 60 years old, at this will shock you, Henry, German university. I'll just throw in there, my wife's last name is Bierman. When I got married, my college friend said, somehow, Mark, we're not surprised you married someone with beer in their last name. And they were each, so these subjects were each given two matched drinking buddies based on age, sex, weight, height, BMI, previous alcohol consumption, and hangover frequency. So I guess this was a highly selected group for that they had hangovers in the first place. And so they created these matched triplets, and they gave them, not that it matters, Carlsberg beer, which is cheap and plentiful here in Europe. And the wine was a chilled white, probably some of the nice Riesling that was in Germany. So they randomly assigned each triplet to a control group or one of two study groups, and each one got a single day of, quote, treatment. The control group consumed only beer or only wine until a breath alcohol level of 0.11% was achieved. And the next session, they switched to the alternate adult beverage. The other two groups, participants consumed beer or wine until they hit 0.05% and then consumed the other beverage to a breath alcohol, again, of 0.11%. A week later, they crossed over to the opposite order of beer and wine. After the, quote, treatment, they all remained on site overnight. I guess it must have been a fun group.
No driving. Yeah.
They were supervised by volunteers, which would have been a terrible job supervising a bunch of drunk people. And they received of course, I was a hall monitor in college, so maybe that's, you know, I should have.
Similar.
Yeah, and they received a standardized meal based on gender-specific and age-specific caloric requirements. The researchers monitored breath alcohol levels, and when the levels reached 0%, usually the morning after, they gave them an 8-symptom acute hangover scale with a range from 0 to 56. And the study was powered with this crossover design. You think maybe 104 patients isn't much, but with the crossover design, it was powered to detect a fairly modest 14% difference in scores, which is kind of the borderline for clinical significance. So, guys, the bottom line, beer first or wine first? Well, doesn't matter. Overall, the three groups had similar hangover severity scores. The range was 10 to 25. Adults who consume fermented beverages shouldn't worry about sticking with one type, wine or beer only, or that the order in which they consume them matters. Now, talk about research you can apply tomorrow. This is great.
Absolutely. I usually will have a beer before dinner and then wine with dinner. So I am greatly relieved.
I have exactly the same habit. And so, we're all relieved. Henry, any comments? I think you wrote this poem up originally.
Yeah, I did. You know, there was a lot of good stuff that they did in this. Some of it's safety related. Some of it is trying to eliminate potential factors that might be associated with hangover, including caloric intake. And we've talked about hangover in the past. So in this study, since the order of fermented beverages really didn't matter, there's another question. Well, what about fermented versus distilled spirits? That sounds
like another study.
Hey, sign me up.
Until we have that study, here would be my guidance, that you drink last the alcoholic product that you like best, that you think tastes best, because that is the one that's most likely to come up first thing.
Oh.
Oh, my.
Nice.
I think we'll censor that out of the broadcast, Henry.
All right. Well, my podcast splicing skills aren't that great, so I think we're stuck with it. Anyway, so on to the next poem. Thank you, guys. Henry, I think this is yours, type 1 diabetes poem.
Yes. So this is by Skipper et al. It's a Danish study published earlier this year in JAMA. They asks the question, are children with type 1 diabetes at risk of lower academic performance? Now, this was a database type study, and we already know that many of the adverse outcomes of diabetes, including hypoglycemia and ketoacidosis and hyperglycemia, might affect cognitive performance. What these researchers did was they looked at multiple registries in Denmark that included school performance, onset of diabetes, how long they had diabetes, A1C levels, frequency of episodes of hypoglycemia, a whole series of things. And they pulled this from a cohort of 631,000 Danish children who attended public schools. Now, about 2,000 of them had type 1 diabetes. They also tried to look at siblings of the children with diabetes in terms of school performance. What did they find? Well, about two-thirds of the kids were using insulin pumps. So that's actually kind of an interesting twist on how type 1 diabetes is managed in children these days. They found no significant difference at all in reading or math scores between children with or without diabetes after they tried to adjust for many confounders, including looking at siblings. So one of the things that they did find, however, was that having an A1C that was over 8.6 over the previous three annual measurements was associated with significantly lower test performance scores. So bottom line, children with type 1 diabetes who are in fair to good control really should not be a concern with regards to school performance. On the other hand, if it's poorly controlled, these are a group that we have to be careful about. Now, there are some issues. One is that this is a retrospective study, can only take into account known confounders. Now, adding the sibling analysis helps with at least eliminating some nurture-related issues. Now, if these data are true, it serves as to me as another example of how type 1 and type 2 diabetes are so different. At least when it comes to the elderly, we know that their cognitive performance is actually better when they run slightly higher glucose values. So very different diseases, and one that we should at least be cautioning our parents about. That's another example of how tight control in patients with type 1 diabetes, at least in children, not only will they have fewer eye complications and improved morbidity and mortality, but in this case, maybe better school performance too.
And a lot of those outcomes that, you know, we talk about the you know, ocular and vascular complications are way off in the future, at least pretty far off in the future for most of these patients. But this is something right in the here and now in terms of school performance that I think gives you another, you know, angle. And I think it's good information. I think we maybe have suspected that, but this is really interesting information. All right, now it's time for the answer to the quiz. We're going to learn about the beer criteria.
Beer's criteria.
So who was beer? Oh, you're going to tell us. Okay.
So this quiz basically asks, the beer's criteria state that one should consume beer before wine to avoid hangovers, to include a very short list of drugs that are approved for use in the elderly. Three are a list of rules that insurers and government agencies should use to deny payment for medications. Four include a list of medications that are definitely inappropriate for use in all elderly patients. And five includes a list of medications that are potentially inappropriate for use in the elderly. So this list was originally developed in 1991 by, of course, somebody named Beer. And these have been applied to medications that potentially create safety issues when used in the elderly. Since 2011, the American Geriatric Society has taken over the coordination and updating of this list. And it's kind of an interesting document because it's a living, breathing list that includes drugs that span multiple categories, including drugs that are potentially inappropriate for use in most elderly patients, those that should be avoided in older patients because of the presence of other comorbid conditions, drugs that we should be cautious about using. It also includes lists of drug-drug interactions that the elderly might be particularly susceptible to, as well as dose adjustments based on kidney function. In this year's update, there were some drugs that were actually kicked off the list, which surprised me. But when I looked, some were kicked off because they're no longer available for use in the U.S. Okay, well, that doesn't help us that much. There were a couple that they removed because the panel thought that these medications actually were not sufficiently unique to the elderly, but would be things that we should avoid using in all patients. For example, using stimulant medications in patients with insomnia and avoiding medications that lower seizure thresholds in patients with a seizure disorder. We have to be careful. These are consensus guidelines about potentially inappropriate medications, or the term PIMS is often used in the literature. So even though they used a very well-defined Delphi process and supplemented this with a real careful review of the literature, there is still a significant element in judgment. And the American Geriatric Society is very clear that these are to be used as a guideline. They caution because often recommendations that are intended to be applied to particular individuals under certain circumstances are often interpreted as black or white. So, for example, my medical record system gives me NAG features anytime I try to prescribe a benzodiazepine or a hypnotic or anything with any kind of anticholinergic to a healthy, hale 65-year-old. So there's often little, people often believe that there's no room for clinical nuance when in fact we are supposed to. Certainly attempts to improve the quality of care for our elderly patients using consensus recommendations are reasonable and appropriate, but when insurance companies start to determine that these are quality measures that have to be applied, then that can incentivize care in potentially more harmful ways. They do talk about in the criteria about trying to, when we identify somebody who's taking one of these medications, to maybe identify maybe appropriate non-pharmacologic kinds of treatments or to identify some options if we have to resort to medications. And occasionally they provide us with some guidance. So this should be a process for starting out identifying medications, and they're a starting point. As we've talked about in the past, there's plenty of room for individual judgment and an opportunity for us to engage in a conversation about the trade-offs of the harms and benefits of medications with our elderly patients.
Thanks, Henry. John, any comments about the Beers criteria?
I think what Henry said about this being a guideline is really important. We had a presentation at one of our on-site courses talking about the bad effects of antipsychotics in those with dementia. And it was a lively discussion. Some of the doctors saying, look, I understand that these are not the greatest, but sometimes there's nothing else to do for a wild patient. And if the patient, well, I would say if the family is willing to bear the risks, that sometimes that's all you can do to get somebody calmed down. So these are guidelines, and there are always exceptions.
Yeah, it does concern me when guidelines that are meant to be interpreted with some nuance get turned into rigid criteria. And I think you're right, Henry. These are a great starting point, and they serve as kind of a backup to our judgment. So they, you know, we should be cautious and thoughtful about using these drugs. But, you know, like you, I've also used some of these drugs in my older patients after considering the benefits and harms. And, you know, on balance, thought it was the right thing to do. And often with discussion with the patient. Of course, then immediately I get a call back from the pharmacist telling me that I shouldn't be giving this to the patient. But in any case, in our clinic, we have sort of in-house pharmacy staffed by pharmacists, and they're great. And they you know this list very well. So then I have to convince a second person. But no, it's a good list. And I appreciate the fact that it's they continue to try to update it and make it more helpful to us. So thanks, Henry. Hope everyone out there has enjoyed today's discussion. Tell your friends, you know, tell your social media folks about Primary Care Update, and give us some reviews, and we look forward to talking to you in a couple weeks. Thanks.